You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Voice of Light, by Durga Chubose. She reads everything. There is no end to her curiosity. It's never homework, it's pleasure, says her Jackie co-star, the writer and director, Greta Gerwig, recalling that Portman threw the cast and crew an epic Hanukkah party. She is known everywhere as a smart actress, thoughtful and precise, not only in her skills, but in the roles she has chosen. Reflecting on her earlier career, Portman says, I was very lucky that what I was cast in wasn't anything deliberate. Serious adult fare and not child-appropriate things. But I feel like I totally ended up in female tropes, like Lolita. And clearly, I was part of the manic pixie dream girl coining. I find it very upsetting to be part of that. Portman met her husband, French dancer and choreographer Benjamin Millepied, on the set of Black Swan. She was soon pregnant, and they married, moving to Paris in 2014 for a two-year stint, where Millepied was the director of dance at the Paris Opera. In 2016, the family moved to Los Angeles. Motherhood has fallen under that private Portman role. She is rarely photographed with her children, unlike many stars, and never shows them on her social media. Her friends know that side of her, though. I think the last time I saw her was a few months ago, with her two kids on her hip on the corner of Melrose and Highland, yelling hello to me across a crosswalk, says Gerwig. When I think of her, I think of her laugh, which is one of the best laughs I know, all bawdy and throaty and loud. And I think of her hollering across an intersection. She is divine. The family recently added a fifth member, an adopted terrier mix. I get the impression Los Angeles is an ideal city for harmonizing family and work, and there is plenty of work ahead. Next will come Xavier Dolan's The Death and Life of John F. Donovan, starring opposite Jacob Tremblay and Kit Harington. Filming began in July for Pale Blue Dot, co-starring John Hamm, Zazie Beetz, and Dan Stevens. Portman also has plans to direct and star in a biopic about the dueling identical twin sisters who wrote advice columns as Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren. Vox Lux, which Brady Corbett describes as half-impressionistic and half-expressionistic, tells the story of Celeste, played in the first half by 15-year-old Raffi Cassidy, the survivor of a harrowing school shooting whose fame is the result of a song she wrote in the hospital with her sister, Stacy Martin, while recovering from bullet wounds to her spine. Portman enters halfway through the film as adult Celeste. Her performance is outsize, in double time. Heavily Staten Island accented, spinning wildly like a broken compass needle, Portman creates chaos with her battery of tics, smacking her gum, sipping wine through a straw, communicating sorrow from behind her big shades, stomping, not heel, but hip first. Portman barrels from scene to scene, speaking in platitudes and paranoid invectives, bullying and picking fights with whoever will listen, her daughter, her manager, played by Jude Law, her sister, concert handlers, a journalist during a hotel round table. Portman also quietly spars with a journalist, played by Billy Crudup, throughout Jackie. In both films, the women are wise to the interminable ways they will be misunderstood, which Portman gets. I just did an interview for a women's issue of a magazine. The female interviewer was like, "So, have you ever had a Me Too story?" "I've had things like every person." And she's like, "Do you want to name names? Do you want to tell us right now?" "On camera," says Portman. I was horrified. That reality helped form the role of Celeste. Portman is quite precise, thorough, says Corbett. "I've been working for 20 years, so I can say with some conviction, Natalie is the best actor that I've ever worked with." It's not hyperbole. It's something really incredible when someone comes in and they color in the lines, but the color is denser and more vibrant than what you had initially imagined. Law, who has worked with Portman on 3 other projects, My Blueberry Nights, Closer, and Cold Mountain, says Portman elevated the whole piece because of who she is. We've met each other at different chapters in our lives, and when you get the opportunity to have pit stops and meet someone along that path, it's really interesting. Over the years, you build a sense of trust and understanding. Corbett and Law both use the analogy of a dancer to describe Portman. While that might seem obvious, not least because of Black Swan, it reminds me of a quote by the writer Maggie Nelson, who once used her history as a dancer to capture the brilliant effect of writing that brushes up against its bad edge. "We were always encouraged to fall in rehearsal so that you could know what the tipping point of any given movement was. That way, when you did it on the stage, you could be sure you were taking it to the edge without falling on your face." It sounds like a cliche, but really, it's just physics. If you don't touch the fulcrum, you'll never gain a felt sense of it, and your movement will be impoverished because of it. What Portman attains is acting that touches the fulcrum. Her power lies in her willingness to go there without runoff. Her twisty focus, like some kind of amulet. She is sharp, indefinite. She visits the screen, looks over her shoulder, canonizes a pink wig, a shaved head, a choker, big headphones, pearls, a pillbox hat, wings, a crown. Cable Madness. Believe me, Donald Trump is the best cable news president in history. Cable news is episodic, confrontational, charged with dark emotion, rival anchor armies jousting with the fate of the world hanging in the balance. The game of Trump may not be good for America, but to paraphrase one disgraced TV mogul, it's very, very good for cable television. Illustrations by Barry Blitt. Opening illustration, Carving the Turkey, which shows a cast of characters around the Thanksgiving table. CNN's Aaron Burnett and Anderson Cooper, Fox News's Laura Ingraham, CNN's Chris Cuomo, MSNBC's Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, CNN's Don Lemon, MSNBC's Nicole Wallace and Rachel Maddow, Fox News's Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity, CNN's Jake Tapper, and MSNBC's Joy Reid. The TV critic-in-chief, at Real Donald Trump. Censorship is a very dangerous thing and absolutely impossible to police. If you are weeding out fake news, there is nothing so fake as CNN and MSNBC. And yet, I do not ask that their sick behavior be removed. I get used to it and watch with a grain of salt, or don't watch at all. At the end of the day, all they want to do is talk about Trump. This article by K. Austin Collins. Did Donald Trump save cable news? Then again, why ask? The truth is tragic, but no righteous person is under any illusions about the answer. How could we be? The arc is obvious. Cable news was in a slump. Then came Trump, and the fate of the Big Three, to say nothing of a sprawling network of subsidiaries and lesser channels, found itself drastically reversed. By quarter two of 2017, half a year into the Trump presidency, Fox News, CNN, and MSNBC all had ratings growth in the double digits. Their virtues are various. Their successes, however, are parallel. MSNBC with its righteous left-leaning outrage. Fox, still the top cable news network since dethroning CNN in 2002, powered by the complacency of political advantage, with CNN stuck somewhere in the middle. The disgraced former CEO of CBS, Les Moonves, once put his network's newfangled dependency on the Trump circus in tragically blunt terms. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. It's true, and it's a tale that is by now as familiar as a bedtime story, though for some of us it has the makings of nightmare fuel. We now rely on the 24-hour gallery of cable news talking heads to tell us not only what happened, not only why it matters, not only whether any of it will make a difference, but more fundamentally, who we are, and how whatever is happening threatens who we are. We rely on these faces to define this question down to the bone, down to even who gets to count as we. It is a great, grave power. Pundits, the likes of MSNBC's Rachel Maddow and Fox News's Tucker Carlson, among others, have become our priest, doling out their polar opposite interpretations of our nation to the impassioned, eager, hungry, and quintessentially divided masses. Throngs of us willingly take in these stories of ourselves, these galvanizing confirmations or disputations of who we are and what we believe, these nightly sermons. And the cable networks, genuinely, seem to have religious power, an inborn capacity for zealotry, to say nothing of power in a pure political sense. This is an era in which a cable news network can play foul-intentioned conciliaire to a president, completely free of conspiracy, just stoking him this way and that, like it's the normalest thing. It's an era in which the bare, threatened, pulsating fact of the news and our deteriorating trust in it is itself one of the prime news stories of the day. In part, because of the vast ideological rifts we suddenly have to account for. And in part, because it's a story whose consequences are as dire as they are late-breaking, immediate. Bad news is, for cable at least, good news. Hence the urgency. This is an era in which real news is labeled fake news, is labeled real news. A claim born of the real fake news. Not that anyone can tell the difference anymore, with all our heads still spinning. Who can keep up? The revolution will not be televised, has been rendered wrong, too, by way of verb tense, because it is happening right now. the Trump Gold Rush at CNN. Perhaps it's no surprise that the programming executive who taught the president all about reality TV also turned a flagging news network into a 24/7 platform for our national psychosis, by Joe Pompeo. In a chart, Trump and Zuck, a tragedy in 5 tweets. At Real Donald Trump, great move by CNN if they sign Jeff Zucker. He was responsible for me and The Apprentice on NBC. Became number one show. At Real Donald Trump, congratulations to at Newt Gingrich on being signed to co-host at CNN Crossfire. Great move by Jeff Zucker. At Real Donald Trump, I can't believe that at CNN would waste time and money with at Smerkonish. He has got nothing going. Jeff Zucker must be losing his touch. At Real Donald Trump, Jeff Zucker failed at NBC and he is now failing at CNN. At Real Donald Trump, the hatred and extreme bias of me by at CNN has clouded their thinking and made them unable to function. Little Jeff Z has done a terrible job. His ratings suck, and AT&T should fire him to save credibility. Number of times Maggie Haberman has appeared on CNN, 452 times as of September 1st. One late summer evening, the inner sanctum of the media entertainment vortex descended upon the expansive garden of David Zaslav's $25 million East Hampton estate, where the well-connected Discovery CEO hosts an annual Labor Day party. This year's guest list comprised the standard liberal in-crowd, Jerry Seinfeld, John Bon Jovi, Oprah, Alec Baldwin, Barry Diller, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and Katie Couric, to name a few. They were treated to a performance by Earth, Wind, and Fire, who belted out September after the sun went down. But there was another set of famous faces mingling in the crowd, the people whose job it is to cover the most compelling reality show in history, the Trump administration, for America's original 24-hour news channel, CNN. Don Lemon, who anchors the network's 10 p.m. hour, introduced his mom and boyfriend to guest. Brian Stelter, host of Sunday's Reliable Sources, made the rounds. Carl Bernstein, who had beamed in for contributor segments over the summer from his place in Sag Harbor, was spotted on the dance floor. Most notable of all was Jeff Zucker, the 53-year-old network president under whose stewardship CNN has become a must-watch platform for nonstop coverage of the Trump White House and all of its attendant hysteria. It was Zucker's first social outing since recovering from heart surgery in early August, and his last before returning to the hellish news cycle. A month later, Zucker was on the phone talking about why Trump sucks up so much of CNN's oxygen. People say all the time, "Oh, I don't want to talk about Trump. I've had too much Trump," he told me. And yet, at the end of the day, all they want to do is talk about Trump. We've seen that any time you break away from the Trump story and cover other events in this era, the audience goes away. So we know that right now Donald Trump dominates. Zucker, the guy who first brought our president to the small screen when he green-lighted The Apprentice in 2004 while running NBC, had arguably schooled Trump in the art of reality television. Halfway through Trump's first term, his instincts are just as acute. If Fox News represents Trump's base and MSNBC has become a friendly platform for the resistance, CNN is the arena where both sides show up for cantankerous battle. on Fox. You rarely hear from people who don't support Trump, Zucker told me. On MSNBC, you rarely hear from people who do support Trump. We want to be home to both those points of view. He continued, as if rebuking a common critique of the network. It is true, some of these folks are not very good with the facts, but that's okay in the sense that it's our job then to call them out. In the current media environment, this is CNN's hallmark. Of course, it's still the network people turn to for coverage of massive news events, natural disasters and war zones, a papal visit or royal wedding, or missing plane. And CNN has been in the game with regular scoops about the ongoing Trump saga and Robert Mueller probe. But a lot of the action these days unfolds in heated panel discussions between pro- and anti-Trump voices, as well as confrontational interviews with White House officials like Kellyanne Conway. I have to check her everywhere, because what she'll do otherwise is flood the zone, said Chris Cuomo, who hosts the 9 p.m. hour on the network. Cuomo and Conway met 25 years ago when they helped create an economic policy think tank. She'll say three things in a row that need a correction. She's really, really good. Conway didn't return a request for comment. The strategy is working. Even though CNN still trails Fox News and MSNBC in primetime audience size, its ratings have never been better. The average number of people watching on a given day has been above 700,000 each year since 2016, compared to around 400,000 in the pre-Trump news cycle. That's also considerably larger than any other time over the past 25 years, an astonishing feat given the ubiquity of news and the decline of cable. The ratings, of course, skew higher in the evening hours when the most people are watching all at once. The average primetime audience is around 1 million, compared to fewer than 600,000 when Zucker arrived in 2013. According to someone with direct knowledge of the numbers, CNN is projected to turn a $1.2 billion profit on $2.5 billion in revenue this year, making 2018 its most profitable year ever. When I came on, someone made a joke that I was starting at the best time because things couldn't get worse from a ratings perspective. We did not have a news cycle to ride, said Aaron Burnett, who joined CNN's primetime lineup in 2011. Now, she continued, we've become a character in this story. It doesn't hurt that the president is a fan, albeit a reluctant one, whose Twitter feed can turn a TV journalist into an overnight celebrity. Lemon told me he wasn't surprised to read a New York Times report noting that Trump hate watches his show in particular. I had spoken to John Heilman and Alex Wagner, he told me, referring to the host of The Circus on Showtime, and they had been doing some reporting, and they said that he watches me every night. And one of the main reasons is because he knows what Sean Hannity's going to say. Hannity's program used to be pre-taped, but he likes to hear about himself in real time, and my show is live, and we have different voices talking about him and analyzing what he has done, and he likes it. Anyone we have on from the White House says the president watches you every night. Another CNN journalist summed up the cable news boom like this. You know how movie stars used to shit on TV, but now TV is like the place to be. We've seen that same reversal. Network news, long hallowed ground, is now arguably the farm team compared to cable. Zucker agrees. Look, I spent 25 years in broadcast news, so I have a pretty good perspective, he said. There is so much more news now, and it's constantly changing. And the news cycle is so fast that cable news is much more relevant today. That's why cable news audiences are up dramatically. It's the nature of the news cycle, the nature of the current president, and the nature of the world we live in. In programming this unprecedented news cycle, the cable news channels have created an entirely new cast of characters. At CNN, that includes administration spin doctors who are invited to come on the air, Rudy Giuliani, Kellyanne Conway, the channel's own ascendant journalist, Jake Tapper, Chris Cuomo, Jim Acosta, and an increasingly prodigious roster of paid analysts whom viewers have come to love or hate, ranging from scoopy newspaper reporters, Maggie Haberman, Josh Dawsey, and recovering politicians, Rick Santorum, Charlie Dent, to experts on such au courant topics as, say, the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, Lara Coates, or the inner workings of the FBI, Asha Rangappa, Phil Mudd. For these contributors, there are benefits to becoming a part of the daily televised drama, aside from the generous, often six-figure rates, they're banking for a side gig. Journalists and experts are able to potentially expand their networks of sources and contacts. Even those who aren't getting paid can substantially boost their profiles. Take Michael Avenatti, for instance, who had appeared on CNN 108 times as of September 1st, according to a recent survey by Cerros, and is now publicly flirting with running for president. All told, there are so many guests constantly cycling in and out of CNN's studios in Washington that the network had to open up a second makeup room there. Every time I ride to the studio, a Washington-based contributor told me, the drivers are talking about, holy shit, Trump's the best thing that's ever happened to our business. There's also a dark side to CNN's resurgence under Trump. It's the CNN sucks placards that are de rigueur at obstreperous campaign rallies. It's the guy who repeatedly called the switchboard threatening to gun down CNN employees. No surprise, CNN has recently been doing active shooter trainings. It's Trump's tweets. The hatred and extreme bias of me by @CNN has clouded their thinking and made them unable to function. Little Jeff Z has done a terrible job. His ratings suck, and AT&T should fire him to save credibility. Zucker, in fact, signed a new contract this year that will take him through the 2020 election. The more Trump attacked Jeff personally, the more he attacked CNN as fake news, a person familiar with the talks said, the more that Jeff dug in. Behind the scenes, even with so many uber-polarized personalities rubbing elbows in the green rooms and makeup chairs of CNN's studios in New York and Washington, the vibe is mostly polite and friendly, according to numerous contributors I spoke with. My experience, said Jeffrey Toobin, the long-serving CNN legal analyst, is that people who disagree profoundly still treat each other in a civilized way off the air. The only exception being Corey Lewandowski, who would storm around and not talk to anybody. Lewandowski, who was no longer a paid CNN contributor, but still occasionally appears as a guest, countered, my relationships at CNN were professional and very good. I enjoyed going out after the shows with many people who were in the green rooms. I just never saw Jeffrey because he wasn't a factor on TV during the last election cycle. Democratic strategist Hillary Rosen recalled a recent blow-up with former Republican presidential hopeful and fellow CNN political contributor Rick Santorum, which carried on for several minutes after their segment had ended, and a production team was scrambling to prep the set for the next show. But she told me that even with an ideological enemy like Santorum, her off-screen interactions are usually kind and respectful. CNN is a civil place, and we all try to learn from each other, even though I disagree with him on virtually... even though I agree with him on virtually nothing and despise his politics. The occasional outburst behind the scenes, however, is not entirely out of the ordinary. During the taping of an episode of State of the Union in January, Tapper pressed White House advisor Stephen Miller about claims from Michael Wolff's book Fire and Fury, but Miller instead launched into a tirade about CNN's coverage, prompting Tapper to cut off the interview. After the cameras stopped rolling, as Business Insider first reported, Miller refused to leave the set and had to be escorted away by security. "That had never happened before," said Tapper, noting that in the world of pro-Trump advocates, "I am perfectly comfortable having on people who represent the Trump point of view." On Lemon's show, one night in late 2016, a dispute between conservative activist Matt Schlapp and South Carolina Democrat Bakari Sellers escalated into a tense and jaw-dropping moment during the commercial break when Schlapp, according to people present, barked at Sellers, "Come at me, boy." Schlapp apologized when they were back on air. "Bakari, I'm sorry I snapped at you." But Lemon told me he hasn't been invited back on the show since. Schlapp didn't return an email. Sellers said, "I don't have any need to be on air with someone like Matt." According to a senior CNN figure I spoke with, there's lots of internal debate and disagreement over who should be on air, about whether some people are too much just mouthpieces for the administration, and whether it's worth paying some of these contributors or giving them an outlet if you feel they are intentionally misleading. Similarly, a source who works in CNN primetime said, "We're dealing with a situation where we have to present both sides, but it kind of feels like it's a no-win game. With the Trump supporters, they either lie or they just can't seem to be straight. There are a few of them who are more believable, but those are few and far between. It's absolutely a frustration." When I was chatting with Lemon before the start of his show one night in an enviable corner office that previously belonged to Piers Morgan, I asked him if he agreed with that assessment. "Yes," he replied, without hesitation. "You do want to hear the other side. You want to hear what people think. But it's frustrating." It wasn't all that long ago that CNN was struggling with a miserable rating slump in the key evening hours. In the few years before Zucker got there, the channel had been stumbling through different primetime experiments. Elliot Spitzer, Morgan, that ultimately failed to get the numbers up. When Zucker arrived in 2013, he began to create some momentum, with a little help along the way from a missing Malaysian airliner and an incapacitated Carnival cruise ship. Trump's political rise was the real game changer. What will happen to CNN when Trump eventually goes away? Whether it's 2020 or 2024, or whenever Robert Mueller reveals some smoking gun, the Trump administration has a sell-by date, and in a way, so does cable news. The medium's core audience is in its mid-60s, and the traditional cable model is being chipped away by each person who cuts the cord in favor of an increasingly palatable spread of streaming options. However, it doesn't hurt that CNN is now owned by AT&T, whose mobile customers can pull the channel up live on their smartphones with the flick of a thumb. Likewise, the network is better positioned than it was 5 years ago, thanks to its gargantuan digital footprint and an aggressive expansion into original series and films, such as Anthony Bourdain's critically acclaimed Parts Unknown. But will it all evaporate when Trump goes away and things go back to normal? It's a question we think about a lot, said Zucker. Just looking at the past 25 years, these last three are among the most successful in CNN history. My view is this. Obviously, our audience numbers will not stay at this level when he's not president, either in 2 years or 6 years. Nobody should be pretending otherwise. I do believe, though, that we have reset the playing field so that our audience levels will be significantly higher than they were. I ask Tapper the same question. I don't take any joy in saying this, he told me, but I would like to disabuse you of the notion that things are ever going back to normal. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections from Vienna Gold. Waltzes, marches, and polkas. A tribute to Johann Strauss. The London Festival Orchestra, conducted by Eric Rogers.